Today is Monday, August 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Thousands continued protesting in Belarus over the weekend, calling for the resignation of President Alexander Lukashenko.
They defied a warning that they could face the military who was stationed around World War II memorials.
Plus, survivors of the 2019 mosque shooting in New Zealand addressed the court today as sentencing procedures began.
I will have permanent disabilities and pain as a result of these injuries.
And the Republican National Convention gets underway tonight. We'll have these stories and more next. Tens of thousands of protesters demanding Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko to step down defied a warning from the military on Sunday and flooded into Minsk, briefly gathering near the president's residence before dispersing peacefully. Reuters' Libby Hogan starts us off.
They defied a warning that they could face the military who was stationed around World War II memorials. Minister of Defense Viktor Krinin.
We categorically warn, any violation of peace and order in such places, you will have the army to deal with now, not the police.
The protests have been the biggest challenge to Lukashenko's rule of more than 26 years in office. Protesters say his recent landslide election victory was rigged. Maria Kolesnikova, one of the opposition, addressed the demonstrators.
Our resistance is a marathon. The regime cannot deal with this marathon. We should all write, go out, stand up, complain, be uncooperative, boycott, not agree, and keep up.
The crowds marched forward, gathering outside the president's residence at the Independence Palace. The first time they've approached the building's doors. Looming overhead, a video by state media showed Lukashenko flying in a helicopter over the protests before landing at his residence clad in body armor with a rifle in hand, and applause from security forces in a later video. The crowd began to disperse in the early evening. Reuters witnessed no clashes with police. Meanwhile, traditional ally Russia issued its strongest comments yet, aimed at opposition candidate Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. After Lukashenko's claims of victory, she fled to neighbouring Lithuania following threats to her safety. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov described her political agenda as destabilising and creating disunity by generating anti-Russian sentiment. But earlier on Saturday, Tsikhanouskaya told Reuters she would not step away from her mission, calling for new presidential elections. She said she would like to see Belarus maintain close relations with Russia, but that Belarus should remain independent.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. Alexei Navalny's wife and a top aide have visited him in a Berlin hospital where the comatose Russian dissident is being treated after a suspected poisoning. Navalny was flown to Germany on Saturday from Siberia after doctors determined that he was stable enough to do so. Doctors at the Siberian hospital that first treated him said on Monday that they had saved his life but did not find any traces of poison in his system. They also denied that they had come under pressure from authorities while treating Navalny. But the team of doctors examining Navalny in Germany said that there were signs of poisoning from a group of compounds known as cholinesterase inhibitors. As the world continues to grapple with nearly 23.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, the World Health Organization held a briefing for reporters today on the global response. WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus provided an update on the research taking place at the COVID-19 Vaccines Global Access, or COVAX, facility.
At present, there are 9 vaccines that are part of this dynamic portfolio, which is constantly being reviewed and optimized to ensure access to the best possible range of products. Even now, discussions are ongoing with 4 more producers, and a further 9 vaccines are currently under evaluation for the longer term.
Tedros said the facility is crucial because it allows the risk to be shared among all those participating. But
most importantly, it is the mechanism to enable a globally coordinated rollout. This is in the interests of all countries, even those that have invested with individual manufacturers independently.
Doing this, Tedros says, will help keep the price of the vaccines as low as possible.
Vaccine nationalism only helps the virus. The world has so far invested $12 trillion in keeping economies moving. Investing in the COVAX facility is the fastest way to end this pandemic and ensure a sustainable economic recovery. Through the allocation framework, COVAX will ensure that low, middle, and high-income countries all receive the vaccine in a timely way as soon as there is supply of a safe and effective vaccine. The success of the COVAX facility hinges not only on countries signing up to it, but also filling key funding gaps for both the research and development work and to support lower-income economies within the facility.
He repeated that the only way through and out of the pandemic was by working together, and that when a vaccine was ready, it was critical to get it to those at highest risk.
This includes health workers as they are on the front lines in this pandemic and critical to saving lives and stabilizing the overall health system. It also includes people over 65 years old and those with certain diseases that put them at higher risk of dying from COVID-19. As supply increases, the next stage of the vaccine rollout would be expanded based on an assessment of each country's vulnerability to the virus.
Dr. Tedros did say that there was a light at the end of the tunnel, and to ensure the global community gets there, he employed everyone to do their part.
If we all physically distance, clean our hands regularly, wear masks, and keep informed, we can collectively break the chains of transmission. Do it all now.
VOA has extended pandemic coverage on our website. The Republican National Convention kicks off tonight in Charlotte, North Carolina. After the Democrats held their week-long virtual event, it's the Republicans' turn to make their case to the American public as to why U.S. President Donald Trump should be elected to a second term. Carolyn Pursuti is in Charlotte.
Well, tonight is what the most important day of the convention. It's the very first day, but it's when all the delegates get together in person, which is very different than how the Democratic National Convention was held. Everything was virtual there. And tonight is roll call. So in the building behind me, this is the Charlotte Convention Center. Now, first, you're going to see all this security. It is a huge perimeter, Steve, around this area. And you can see these huge metal barriers. They extend for blocks and blocks behind us. But right behind, you can see almost that red, white, and blue welcome sign on the convention center. That's where the 336 delegates will be headed to this morning, and then they'll stay there all afternoon. Their session starts with various meetings, setting the platform, and then they have what's called roll call. So six delegates per state will say whom all their votes go to, and of course that will naturally be President Trump, who will be their nominee by the end of the week, and this will end with an acceptance speech by him from the White House on Thursday.
The Democratic National Convention featured a cavalcade of who's who in politics. Who's on tap to speak in this first night for the Republicans?
Absolutely. You know, one thing that's being said about this convention is that the Republicans had the benefit of seeing the DNC first last week, right? And so they're going to try to top that. And of course, the president has a lot of experience with production, having been the executive producer, the star, if you will, of The Apprentice show, a TV show here in the United States. So it's expected to have a lot of glitz and glamour. There are a lot of politicos on the agenda for tonight. The most recognizable name, if you will be Donald Trump Jr. and his girlfriend. They will be here. There will be senators, Republican senators speaking, and various politicos around here. But you can see this security. The president is expected to address the convention in its first day. He is arriving in North Carolina and will be speaking at a farm about 2 hours west of here and then stopping by Charlotte.
The road to the Republican convention was marred by a lot of controversy over precautions for COVID-19. What do you know about the precautions in place for the pandemic?
The delegates were prepped with regards to COVID testing, COVID monitoring. Before they even left their states, they were tested. As soon as they got here, they were tested. Every day they are monitored. They have to check in via their mobile phones. In addition to that, they wear a tiny monitoring device. It's a little black device around their ID tags. And that tells them who they've been in contact with. Just in case somebody comes down with COVID, then that becomes their tracer to let them know if they've been around someone who has then come down with the virus. So it's very strict. Masks must be worn. I'm outside without a mask because there's no one around me. There's no one around me for longer than 6 feet. But anytime we walk around Charlotte, anytime we're inside, we do wear our masks.
That's VOA's Carolyn Pursuti in Charlotte, North Carolina. White House advisor Kellyanne Conway said on late Sunday that she will be leaving the Trump administration at the end of August, citing the need to focus on her family. Reuters' Gloria So has that story.
Key White House advisor Kellyanne Conway announced late on Sunday she is leaving the Trump administration to make more time for her family. In a statement released on Twitter, Conway called her time at the White House, quote, heady and humbling, and said she would be transitioning from the White House at the end of this month. Conway has been one of Trump's most loyal and outspoken defenders in public and on cable news. Her departure comes at a crucial time for the president. It leaves Trump without one of his more passionate and high-profile spokespersons some 2 months ahead of the general election, when Trump will be seeking a second term. Conway served as Trump's third campaign manager in 2016 and later became the first woman to successfully engineer a presidential campaign to victory. She has also survived several rounds of staff turnovers in an often chaotic and drama-ridden White House. Conway's family has been the subject of public speculation since last year when Trump called husband George a, quote, whack job and a husband from hell. George Conway has been a vocal critic of the president. In a separate statement on Twitter, George said he was also stepping back from his duties at the Lincoln Project, a prominent Republican-backed group opposing Trump's re-election. It says its self-proclaimed mission is to defeat Trump and Trumpism at the ballot box.
Reuters reporter Gloria So. And coming up later,
a delegation from the 15-nation Economic Community of West African States arrived in Bamako on Saturday with the aim of reversing a coup. Wary of prolonged instability in a region that has seen escalating Islamist militancy, ECOWAS has taken a hard line on the ouster of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
If you were in an area with very little light pollution and looked up at the sky on a dark, clear night, you might notice a faint green glow. What you'd be seeing is a constant upper atmospheric phenomenon called air glow, caused by the interaction of sunlight on oxygen molecules. Until recently, this phenomenon has only been spotted above Earth. A new study led by astronomers at Belgium's University of Liège describes the detection of a faint green glow in the atmosphere of Mars. The scientists analyzed the data they gathered from NOMAD, an instrument aboard the ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter, which has been studying the Martian atmosphere for past or present signs of life since 2016. The scientists say the glow mostly peaks at 80 kilometers with another at 120 kilometers above Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A sentencing hearing has begun for the Australian man who carried out the mosque attacks in the New Zealand city of Christchurch back in March of 2019. Brenton Tarrant has admitted to killing 51 worshippers and injuring dozens more. In court on Monday, the self-confessed white supremacist has come face-to-face with relatives of some of his victims. Phil Mercer reports.
A year after his deadly rampage, Brenton Tarrant pleaded guilty to the murders of 51 Muslim worshippers, 40 charges of attempted murder and a terrorism offence. The 29-year-old Australian man had earlier denied attacking two mosques during Friday prayers in Christchurch, New Zealand, before reversing his plea. A sentencing hearing began Monday and is expected to last 4 days. Tarrant faces a minimum prison term of 17 years, but Justice Cameron Manda, the High Court judge in charge of the case, has the authority to order him locked away for life with no parole, a sentence that has never been handed down in New Zealand. More than 60 people will deliver victim impact statements to the court. Some have travelled from overseas and undergone a mandatory two-week COVID-19 quarantine in order to take part. Among the victims was 35-year-old Hussein Al-Omari. His sister Aya says she wants to look his killer in the eye and tell him her spirit has not been crushed.
My plan is to eyeball him. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to tell him what he intended to do has done the complete opposite effect. Okay, you've killed my brother, but God is still there. So, I don't know, we'll see how it goes.
Brenton Tarrant's crime sent waves of grief around the world. Many of his victims were migrants and refugees from India, Somalia, Egypt, Syria and Jordan. The youngest to die was a three-year-old boy. The attacks horrified New Zealand, an isolated country of 5 million. Its people invariably saw their country as a safe place, far from the extremist violence that scarred other parts of the world. That changed in March 2019. The Friday prayer murders in Christchurch prompted the New Zealand government to ban the military-style semi-automatic weapons that were used by the gunmen. He live-streamed part of his rampage, adding to the trauma of his victims' families. This week, they can tell their stories of pain, loss and survival at the High Court in Christchurch. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
West African mediators and Mali's coup leaders have agreed on certain points in negotiations aimed at restoring civilian rule following the ouster of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita nearly a week ago. Reuters' David Doyle has this update.
They've not revealed what they've agreed on, but West African mediators and Mali's military junta say they found consensus on certain aspects during negotiations aimed at returning the country to civilian rule.
All of us want the country to move on.
A delegation from the 15-nation economic community of West African states arrived in Bamako on Saturday with the aim of reversing a coup. Wary of prolonged instability in a region that has seen escalating Islamist militancy, ECOWAS has taken a hard line on the ouster of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, closing borders, suspending financial flows and reducing engagement. But one diplomat told Reuters that reinstating Keita is not an option. Meetings were held behind closed doors on Sunday and progress was made. That's according to former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, who leads the ECOWAS delegation.
We have reached a number of agreements, but we have not reached agreement in all the issues.
As well as junta spokesman Colonel Ismail Wagye.
Discussions are continuing. We have reached compromise points on certain aspects, and negotiations will continue tomorrow.
A senior officer close to the junta, which is known as the National Committee for the Salvation of the People and is led by Colonel Assimi Goita, said the ECOWAS sanctions were discussed on Sunday morning. Other key issues would include Keita's fate and details of Mali's transition to civilian rule. Though the coup was condemned internationally, it has been welcomed by many in Mali, which has seen months of unrest over a disputed election and perceived government corruption and incompetence.
Reuters reporter David Doyle. A Taliban political team has arrived in Pakistan as efforts appear to be ramping up to get negotiations underway between the Afghan government and the insurgent group. The meetings come at a crucial time in Afghanistan's conflict, with talks stalled once again amid a controversial prisoner swap. The Taliban and the Afghan government had signaled that they were prepared to start talks immediately after the Muslim festival of Eid, but the process remains bogged down over the prisoner exchange. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has landed in Israel, the first leg of his Middle East tour, to press the momentum of the Trump administration's Arab-Israeli peace push. Pompeo first met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday in Jerusalem. Pompeo said that the United States would continue to ensure Israel enjoys a military edge in the Middle East under any future U.S. arms deal with the United Arab Emirates. In addition, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised the United States for reissuing fresh sanctions on Iran. Greece says it will conduct a Navy and Air Force exercise in the area of the Eastern Mediterranean, where Turkey is prospecting for oil and gas as the neighboring countries remain locked in a dispute over offshore energy rights. Authorities said on Monday that the live fire exercises would start Tuesday southeast of the Greek island of Crete and end Thursday. Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas is planning to speak to both countries and says Berlin regrets Ankara's decision to extend an exploration ship's activities in the area. The Turkish government disputes Greece's claim to exclusive rights in the waters where the research vessel is working. There's a new addition to the National Zoo in Washington, and Reuters' Jillian Kitchener has that story.
There's a new bundle of joy buried in giant panda Mei Zhang's fur. A healthy cub was born Friday at the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C., but the sex is still a mystery at this early stage. Zoo officials say they are thrilled by the new addition, especially since the 22-year-old panda had a slim chance of having a healthy cub because of her age. In fact, the zoo only confirmed this week that she was pregnant following an ultrasound. Mei Zhang was artificially inseminated in March with previously frozen sperm after failed pregnancy attempts and despite her being near the end of her reproduction life cycle. The new cub has three siblings, one of which is D.C.'s beloved Bebe, who left for China in November as part of a breeding program. There are only about 1,800 giant pandas in the wild, making the new little one, coddled by its mom, a welcome gift to the zoo and the world.
That was Reuters reporter Jillian Kitchener. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for joining us. Now, be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com on your phone, your tablet, or any other electronic device. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Longtime president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, who has held the country's top elected post since 1994, claimed yet another landslide victory in the presidential election that took place on August 9th. His claim of a victory with 80% of the vote is disputed by hundreds of thousands of Belarusian citizens, many of whom took to the streets in protest, saying that the results were falsified. Government forces responded swiftly and brutally to the protests, beating, arresting, and detaining protesters, journalists, and members of the opposition by the thousands. At least four protesters were killed. After the election, two of Belarus's opposition leaders fled the country, including leading opposition candidate Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, who ran for the presidency after her husband Sergei, a political blogger, was jailed and barred from the presidential race. The protests continue in many of Belarus's cities. Over 100,000 protesters rallied in Minsk on August 16th, an unprecedented turnout in Belarus. A number of protesters are part of the Women in White campaign, who have taken to the streets to protest the violent crackdown and call for the release of loved ones detained by police. The women, dressed in white and often carrying flowers, began appearing last week in Minsk, but several protests have also taken place in Germany, Poland, Belgium, Ukraine, and Russia. It is clear from the response of the Belarusian people to the disputed election that they are yearning for something that Alexander Lukashenko has not afforded them in the 2.5 decades he has held power. The international community has heard the call of the Belarusian people and stands with them in their democratic aspirations. The United States, as well as European leaders, have expressed deep concern over the conduct of the election in Belarus, noting it was neither free nor fair, as well as the government's violent response to the subsequent protests, the apparent targeting of journalists, the severe abuses against detainees, and the internet blackout. During his recent visit to Poland, Secretary of State Pompeo said, "The common objective is to support the Belarusian people to achieve their own sovereignty, their own freedom, to build out what you're seeing happen in these protests. These people are demanding the simple things that every human being wants, the right to have determination for themselves, the nature of their government. And so we urge the leadership of Belarus to broaden the circle, to engage with civil society in a way that reflects the central understandings that the Belarusian people are demanding."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.